We have a lot to talk about.
We have a lot to talk about, and I actually want to go back to the previous episode. Hello, welcome, it's the show. Sarah's back, say hi, Sarah.
Hi, I'm still here.
And we got cut off last time. We rushed through talking about Egos Duikana because of the cap on Google Meet calls. And if that happens again, we're going to just do another call because it's too important. We can't let Google tell us when to stop talking.
I feel like this is a two-call episode, but we'll see.
But I'm saying that if we get to another... like last time, we were just about to end the second call, and we said, let's hurry it up so we don't have to go into a third call. I say we should have gone into the third call.
No, I think it's more fun the way we did it.
It's more fun, but then we miss out on all the cool things that I would have said.
Well, we're ready. We're here to talk about them now. Okay. Tell me about Egos Duikana.
What a cool skeleton.
Agreed.
With a cool crown. Kind of a Chinese-looking crown, right?
I don't know what a Chinese crown looks like.
Well, like, the very old style of Chinese crown would have the thing going across with, like, the tassels hanging down.
Oh, I see what you mean. Cao Cao definitely wore this.
And he's big. These are big people. Big skeletons. And he teaches you the Elegy of Emptiness, which we talked about. It is supposed to give you a soldier with no heart, right?
Yeah. Like Kingdom Hearts.
Exactly. It's a crossover. The, it, of course, turns you into, or like causes you to leave behind a shell of yourself. So like a creepy dead corpse of Goron Link or Zoro Link or Deku Link or Link. They're all replaced with these very creepy looking mannequins. And I had in my notes that this seems to develop or perhaps invert the theme of masks by... It seems to be saying that, like, when the Song of Healing turns a trauma or a soul into a mask, and externalizes that as like a shell that can then be worn by something else, this song seems to be doing the same thing, but like backwards. Am I talking nonsense?
I see where you're going, but I can't quite parse it.
Yeah. So you're so the real you is still in your body?
Apparently. It's like the real you is still there, but the face that you put on to show everyone, you are stripping that off or making a copy of that. And like the identity of Link is what is left behind as a creepy statue.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
And the word identity in my notes gets thrown around a lot because identity, again, here is something that's not innate to you that you can't, like, it's not the thing that you are still walking around with, right? It's something that you can shed.
Yeah.
So where is your identity and where is your soul if these masks can be considered your soul, like Captain Kida says? The whole idea of self is problematized all the way up and down this game.
Maybe these are just a different type of shedding of your part of yourself than the masks are.
Could be. But it does seem that way.
Specifically, that is some way artificial. Or not, maybe artificial is not the word, but it's like lesser than the way identity is represented in masks.
The empty.
When you put on the Zora mask and you see Mikhail's corpse face screaming in pain, I almost feel like the Elegy of Emptiness statue of Mikau is trying to be the same thing as that glimpse of Mikau's face when you put on his mask. I am not enthusiastic about separating those. I think that the Elegy of Emptiness and the Song of Healing are kind of pointed in the same direction, shall we say. But I don't think there's any clear explanation of what actually is going on. Like everything else in this game.
There's also,
speaking of which, yes,
the fact that you can be someone else and then create a shell of that person. So there's like layers of shells.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Well, it would seem to lean toward the side of this identity, in big quotation marks, being a total construction with no permanence. If you can just drop copies of them all over the place and add them to yourself at any time, identity would seem to be a fairly cheap commodity.
It's transient.
We also said on that episode that we were going to talk about, have these undead characters in Ikana ever been alive? Did we reach a conclusion?
I don't remember.
I mean, I know we didn't, but I was wondering whether you guys had thoughts about this that we didn't get to say on that episode.
It sounds like they have. I mean, they have histories. Some of them do. Or maybe they don't. Maybe the histories were as their skeletons.
Right?
Yeah. There's, do they ever say, like, we have a skeleton army, or do they just say we have an army?
They always leave it up to interpretation of that. And there's precedent in Zelda for, like, just skeletons as dudes.
Right.
Out in the world.
Yeah, I guess there's not too many characters who talk about, like, their previous lives. Do Sharp and Flat do, right?
I don't think they actually say that they were alive.
Hmm.
They say that they, like, worked for the Ikana royal family.
But
and
were they alive?
We don't know.
Regardless of if they were like alive or not, we're at a state, like a world state of the Ikana area as like devoid of civilization, right? There's not just people around in the same way, even if there were like undead people versus living people or whatever. So I'm not sure where that lands.
And the Garo, when they talk about being just an empty shell of a guy, a Garo robe is just a robe with nobody inside. Was that always the case?
I thought for some reason that they were somewhere after alive. Like, not like they used to be alive. And they were sticking around after death to continue their habits of being these weird spy characters.
You know, if when you say the word death, like Captain Kita says, convey my words to my men who even in death remain loyal to me. Well, then they must have been alive at some point if they could die.
Yes, that's in proof.
Okay. QED.
I mean, maybe there's multiple levels of death in this.
Yeah.
Maybe there's alive skeletons versus dead skeletons. That sounds... maybe. When I started... You know when you start to say something and you're like, this is a good thing I'm saying. This is a smart, insightful thing I'm saying. And then you say it and you're like, no, that you were wrong on that one.
Well, this is a fantasy world. Anything's possible. There could be undead skeletons.
And I think that, like you were saying, it is ambiguous. I think it is contradictory in a sense. And there can't be a, there is no actual answer, because by this point of the game, the real world that you're supposedly interacting with has become extremely abstract. And when we talk about the Stone Tower Temple, which apparently is what this episode, or supposedly is what this episode is about, the Egos says that this all these problems happened when the doors to Stone Tower were thrust open. And there really is not even a lean or a nod to why that is the case. How does opening the doors of the Stone Tower cause all these undead people to have problems? There's no indication. And yet, that's where we need to go to solve all these problems, supposedly.
I think that trying to find an answer to that is only going to lead to more questions.
Well, let's go and enter Stone Tower Temple.
Well, first we go to the, like, Stone Tower.
Oh, yeah.
First we have to talk about the physicality of the Stone Tower itself.
Yeah. Did we talk about how you can see it from the ranch?
We haven't. Oh, no. Oh, yeah, we did. Did we?
Okay.
Maybe.
You can see it from the ranch. You can see it from Termina Field. I almost want to say you can see it from... Uh-oh, better open no clip. The Goron Village? Am I wrong about this?
I don't remember.
It is very tall.
I'm going to check. You guys talk.
It's this huge, imposing, like, structure that's, like, it looks like a bug, like an insect hive.
Mm. Mm. It looks different from far away than it does when you're in it.
Yeah. When you're inside, it doesn't have that weird bulbous quality. Yeah.
Well, it does, but, like, it's like there's these giant bulbous, like, structures. I don't know, natural or otherwise, that have, like, alcoves in them at set intervals. And within that is this very, like, manufactured, like, apartment building cell block horror show of a platforming challenge. That is a lot to deal with.
Yeah, I feel like when I first played this, I got really frustrated by this, the inside of this tower. And by the time I climbed it, I was ready to be frustrated some more. But that's because I didn't know how to make it easier.
I don't know how to make it easier.
In Goron Village, the Stone Tower Temple is visible across the way, but only when you bring springtime to Snowhead.
Hmm.
Which is weird because there are still clouds, but the clouds have cleared up just enough for you to be able to see Snowhead if you happen to turn that way.
That's nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, this place is creepy and weird. And, like, implies, like, a greater structure to it. Like,
yeah.
That you don't see. It.
When you see all those, like, alcoves or arches from the outside, you'd think that it must be a huge prison sort of thing. And you're only seeing the most innermost part of it when you actually ascend it in the game.
And you're not entering that structure at all. Except to, like, get from the main Akana Village area into here. There's, like, one passageway there, but none of the rest of these, like, cells are interior spaces at all.
Hmm.
Yeah. It's like what you ascend in when you're in quote unquote Stone Tower is the, like, courtyard in between all those bulbous towers.
Yeah. Ugh. So we put our newfound musical skills to the challenge to get up here.
Oh, yes. You apply the Elegy of Emptiness to, and well, this is what's frustrating. Is you use your Elegy of Emptiness statues to hold down switches that make blocks move around, but you need to make them move around in a certain order, because if they run into each other, then they just stop. And that's frustrating. It's a lot of going back and forth.
Yeah,
it's obnoxious. I think it would be more fun if there weren't a bunch of enemies trying to attack you at the same time.
Hmm. Yeah, there's a lot of bats. There's a lot of bombos.
I always think that there's a heart piece somewhere up here, and there never is.
Me too. Shouldn't there be a heart piece, like, in the fire on top of that big finger?
I was thinking, yeah, they They built this whole area, and it's entirely just this preamble to getting to the temple that we're going to talk about eventually on this episode about this temple. And there's, like, space for there to be more there, but there's just not. I don't know.
No, and part of that has to be that this whole space functions as a prelude to the dungeon. And I don't think they want it to be too much of, you know, like an adventure space that you explore necessarily. It's a transition, and having you like find cool secrets on the way would be kind of a distraction from the rising tension that they're trying to produce.
It must be, because they would do that many times in other Zelda games.
Absolutely.
And then choose not to do it here.
Much has been made of the blocks that you move around, and supposedly they have Triforces on their butts. And there's a famous theory that this is all some sort of, like, heretical blasphemy against the normal Hyrule religion somehow.
Sure. Okay. I don't know.
I remember reading this article years ago, and I think it's well put together, and it was, you know, a lot of good like a lot of good support for the case, but I don't see the creators of Majora's Mask having such a specific intent in mind. Because there's nothing at all in the rest of the game to make you think that the what's going on here is about the Triforce in any way.
Zelda's not interested in cosmology in that same way that I think
not usually
some people put on it.
I think they have their ups and downs of caring about cosmology. Because it's not always the same guys writing these games.
Sometimes it's Grezzo.
Yeah. And you could make the case that Grezzo is much more interested in that kind of nerdy stuff, but Grezzo was not the ones who put the Triforces on the butts. So anyway, let's get to the top. There's this big scary face. We've kind of gotten back to Link to the Past, where the dungeon entrance is a scary face. And I was thinking about your theory, Zach, and like trying to think, could this have been designed for 2D? Or I forget what your theory was, but my theory was that like Woodfall was designed in 2D first, I guess. My theory based on your theory. And
I was going to say, wait a second.
There's a
transitive property here.
There's a, like, I can imagine the block moving puzzle as being something in 2D, kind of. Like, you could do that same kind of thing with holding down switches that make blocks move that blah, blah, blah. But I don't think you can then apply that to Stone Tower Temple itself. I think that doing that in 2D is ridiculous.
Yeah, given the nature,
would have that idea.
Given the nature of, you know, the dungeon we're about to talk about, I think it makes sense that they definitely thought of this as a 3D space.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have a story about the Stone Tower Temple.
Okay.
And my, like, perceptions of it. So, as previously discussed, I messed around with Majora's Mask when it was, like, out on N64 for the first time, but never really got very far. I might have beaten Ottawa, like, once. It's, like, maybe the farthest I ever got in the year 2000 or 2001 or whatever I played it. And so my next, like, real exposure to the game was in 2008, when somehow I got hooked up to somebody's Justin.television channel, and I watched somebody stream a bunch of Zelda stuff.
Justin.television. Never mind.
This was like the first time I'd ever like watched somebody stream a video game on the internet, which is like an incredibly novel. It's novel to think of that as a new thing. Given that now there's so much of that, but like I went and tracked it down because I sent these guys emails because I was so excited that they were playing Zelda online. They had like a pizza fund up, like you can PayPal us money and we'll spend it on pizza, and they ended up raising an amount they were very proud of $1,200.
Wow,
that is very good for what, 2008.
For 2008, yeah. They were super stoked. They ended up giving it to charity instead of buying pizza with it or whatever. Anyway, so I – just a weird early – not early internet, but like a weird older internet thing that happened that I was thinking about. Because what ended up happening is they were playing all four of the three-dimensional Legend of Zelda games. They played Ocarina of Time, Wind Waker, Twilight Princess, and they also played Majora's Mask. But they were playing Majora's Mask on – the GameCube port of it that came with that collector's disc, which famously is pretty buggy. And so they were like a 24-hour stream. I remember watching them starting Stone Tower Temple like really late as I was going to bed. And then I woke up a few hours later to get up and do whatever I was doing. And they were still on that dungeon. And I didn't realize at the time it was because the game kept crashing in the middle of the dungeon, but instead it gave the impression of Stone Tower Temple as being this like dungeon that is like the most impossible dungeon to end all dungeons in Zelda, like the hardest possible thing that has ever happened. And cool. That impression stuck around a long time until I finally played it and was like, oh no, this is, it's a big dungeon, but it's still just a regular dungeon.
It is a hard dungeon, but I mean, I could see taking hours to get through it. There's a lot of little things you have to notice.
I think that, you know, if any dungeon in this game is going to be that dungeon, it's Stone Tower Temple. It's very big. I had, along similar lines, I had this whole list of this theory that I might have talked about when we talked about Link's Awakening and Turtle Rock, of distinguishing between the final dungeon and the climactic dungeon, or the biggest dungeon. Because in most Zelda games, the game ends with a dungeon that is bigger and badder than all the others. But in Link's Awakening, Turtle Rock is bigger and badder than all the others, but it's not the last dungeon because then you go to the egg, which is barely a dungeon. It's basically just a boss fight. And I think in Majora's Mask, similarly, the final dungeon, if we take the moon as a dungeon, is pretty laid back compared with Stone Tower Temple. And Stone Tower Temple is the biggest, baddest one of the game. They in both Link's Awakening and Majora's Mask, you don't want the last thing to be that bombastic of being the biggest challenge, because those games are concerned with making a mood that you need to have something a bit quieter at the end. And then I look through all the other games, and of the Zelda games I know enough about to say anything. Basically all the other ones, the last dungeon is the biggest. Whenever Ganon's tower is involved, it has to be the nastiest. But in the Oracles, the final dungeons are less impressive, but I don't think of the eighth dungeons in those games being like especially like Turtle Rock like. Do you agree, Zach? Sarah, did you play the Oracles?
I did play one of them a long time ago. I don't remember the dungeons too well.
So let me think. The final dungeon is just like here's the hallway and then the boss. And then the penultimate, the dungeon 8 in each of those games is usually a much bigger dungeon. One of those ones I like a lot. The other one...
Is it the one in Ages?
I don't
In Ages, remember. It's like... I think yes. It's called Ancient Tomb.
Yes,
and
yes,
like
yes, yes, yes.
Really ridiculous.
It's really good. That was just a good dungeon. The other one I was going to say is...
Yeah?
What was the other one? It's the one in Holodrum.
Right, right.
Which is, I did not
and
remember
I guess,
a good dungeon.
Being in Holodrum is a very good point in that dungeon's favor, but... it's just a like fire and ice gimmick, and it doesn't really stand up to the Ancient Tomb or to Turtle Rock as like, whoa. But I wanted to ask about Twilight Princess and Skyward Swords. Skyward Swords is what it's called. The two that I haven't played.
Sarah,
it looks like, yeah.
I was going to ask Sarah if she played those
I played Twilight Princess, and I don't remember the order of the dungeons.
Okay, that's not a big recommendation on Twilight Princess.
Oh, I really like Twilight Princess. I just have a bad memory.
Oh, okay. Zach?
Hi.
What's the biggest dungeon, the cool dungeon, the best of Twilight Princess?
Twilight Princess ends weird. So the, like, last dungeon is, like, a cool set piece with some fun stuff in it, but I wouldn't necessarily consider it like a good dungeon in like the puzzly aspect. And then the dungeon before that is the one that would be more similar to like an ultimate dungeon in that it's kind of just a series of challenges you have to overcome one by one.
So pacing wise, it's the same thing as here where you have penultimate dungeon is big deal. Final dungeon is kind of a cool down, because I know that Twilight Princess is kind of trying to do the same moodiness as maybe not the same moodiness, but a moodiness where Link's Awakening and Majora are also trying to be moody and don't want to blow your head off with the final dungeon being Ganon's Tower nightmare.
Twilight Princess also just has a lot of dungeons, so like by the time you're in the back like quarter, they maybe aren't like trying to achieve the same thing as like a regular Zelda dungeon because they've gotten past that in some ways.
Okay. That's interesting. What about Skyward Sword?
What are the dungeons in Skyward Sword? The final dungeon in Skyward Sword, it's a series of rooms that are all like puzzles from other parts of the game that you then move around like a grid. You have to do a slide puzzle to...
I was seeing that, and I thought that was kind of like similar to the Stone Tower Temple gimmick, kind of. Don't you think?
In some sense,
in terms of manipulating the dungeon.
Yeah.
And using everything you've gotten so far.
Yeah.
Sure. That's the other thing that... It's the ultimate dungeon in that, the case I would make for Stone Tower Temple is it doesn't rely on a single theme. It's more like the theme is testing all the stuff you've done before.
Yeah. In my head, my memory of it was that there were like discrete like wings of the dungeon dedicated to each form of Link. And it was delightful actually playing it and being like, oh, no, it's way more blended than that. It's not nearly as like, maybe I had conflated that in the, when we get to the moon stuff in my head.
Sure. But Stone Tower Temple does try to feature all of the forms of Link.
Yeah.
It's not dedicated to one, like, well, I mean, and it kind of, Ikana Valley Canyon Zone kind of wants to be like the human Link zone to feature normal Link as opposed to the other ones that feature all the other forms, but in a big way this dungeon is about featuring all four guys.
That's cool. I like that.
Yeah,
and they do a good job of it.
It's so big and scary and hard and good.
Yeah, it seems like it's going to be so intimidating, so that makes it that much more fun to actually figure out what you're supposed to do. It's very satisfying.
And I feel like it looks very nonlinear in its layout. And when you actually play through it, it ends up being pretty linear. Like, it's not like there's a lot of situations where there are multiple different things you could do. But collecting all the stray fairies makes it very confusing and nonlinear because they don't put the fairies in your path. They make you go out and turn things upside down and then come back and then do that several times to get all the fairies.
Yeah, I guess it would be hard to tell if you're on the main path or the fairy, a fairy branch of the dungeon. Yeah. Sometimes.
What else is there to say about Stone Tower Temple? Well, you get to flip it upside down.
Yeah, that's a big one.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
It blew my mind. I mean, you see the upside down chests and you see like symbols on the ceiling when you walk in and things, but I guess I assumed you're going to be walking around on the ceiling or the wall. And, you know, I've seen that before. It wasn't, you know, it's cool, but it's, I wasn't expecting the entire thing to flip. It's very cool.
It's so cool. It's like, you know, suddenly the sky becomes your nemesis where it's like, oh,
yeah,
now I need to not fall up infinity. And like,
I was trying to think back to all the other dungeons and whether they relied on bottomless pits, which they mostly don't. Like, the main dungeons, I don't think have any bottomless pits. The only one I could think of in the game actually was in the Iconic Graveyard. Are there any bottomless pits elsewhere? There must be, right?
I mean, there's a bottomless pit at the center of Akana Tower.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
So that's just kind of a bottomless pit each direction.
Yes. But, like, I think that the fact that the game doesn't rely on bottomless pits as obstacle most of the time makes the bottomless sky feel all that much more scary than if this had been... bottomless pit centric game all the time.
I hadn't thought about that, the lack of pits. Also, the fact that it's not dark is kind of disconcerting. It's like a bright pit.
It's this oppressive light of the sky.
It's just that you're
trying to avoid.
And in that one chamber, it like shoots into the room as air currents. And you need to fly around as Deku Link. You can understand that that's something coming out of the sky. Like, of course, the weird, like, it's not a normal sky that you're doing all this on top of. It's a scary elemental energy source.
Yeah, because you're not actually flipping the temple, right? It's just like a symbolic flipping. Because isn't it mirrored backwards, too?
Yeah, it's... I think that it's more accurate to say that it's mirrored along the Z-axis because what's on your left when you enter is still on your left when you enter after flipping it.
Yeah.
If they actually did rotate it along the axis of where you enter it, then it would be... They must have tried that, I think. And it was too confusing because you would enter and you would go in the door on the right and it would be what you're expecting to find on the left.
Yeah, that'd be disorienting.
Disorienting.
More disorienting.
Yeah. Gotta get the balance right with the disorienting quality of this dungeon.
The thing is, this already happened earlier in the game.
Oh. You're talking about the very, very beginning.
The very beginning, when you enter Termina, you have that hallway that flips over. And I don't think that's a coincidence. I think that when they create a mirror dungeon, or you create the mirror of Stone Tower Temple by flipping it over, you're doing what Majora's Mask has been doing all along – by creating this uncanny copy of the world that you're used to. And like throughout Majora's Mask, it has played on your expectations of Ocarina of Time to create that sense of the uncanny. And now it puts that power into your hands and you do the same thing and you conquer this temple by navigating both its normal version and its uncanny copy. So I think that like the theme of Stone Tower Temple is the whole game of Majora's Mask.
What you just described is also the same thing you're doing with the empty shells of Link.
Speak on that. What are you talking about?
You're manipulating a copy. It made sense when a second.
Yeah.
You're you've got a different. It's like a clone sort of.
Yes.
That you're using and manipulating.
Well, shoot fire. This is a really smart podcast. Yeah, so that's the theme of the game.
Yeah,
and we the got theme it. Of the temple. And well, my notes after that are just about the various bosses. Are there any other stuff to talk about?
I've got a couple things. Can we Hit talk me. About this giant stone effigy of Majora's Mask at the entrance of the dungeon?
Oh, yeah! There seems to be a great big Majora's Mask.
Like, it's not quite that, but it's close enough to that that you have to be like, well, is that, that must be what they're going for, right?
It's gotta be. It's, I mean, it can't be an accident.
Is that one of the faces that look different upside down when you flip the dungeon? I can't picture what that Majora's Mask is.
It's the authentic screen.
As soon as you enter the dungeon proper, you're in that big room and it's got the exits to the left and the right and forward. And there's a big face. It's obviously a face hanging up ahead of you.
Okay.
But it's not until you go upside down or that you flip the whole thing that it, you notice it has the basic like heart-shaped shape and some of the spikes that remind you of Majora's Mask. And it's really not like a one-to-one thing.
No, it's like an abstraction that you could say one way or the other. I sent it to.
Oh, okay, yeah.
If you turn your head upside down, you look at that.
Turn your monitor upside down.
Yeah.
And
I don't have anything bigger to say about it, but it's cool that it's there.
Yeah.
Well, it certainly seems to suggest a. Like a clue, perhaps, into where Majora is from. What is Majora? Where did this mask come from? Where is this evil tribe with their hexing rituals? It would seem that whoever is in charge of the Stone Tower Temple is connected to whatever Majora is in some way. And so it's appropriate that this is like the big climactic dungeon where you perhaps are facing Majora's home turf, if that makes sense.
I think that makes sense. I think, you know, we didn't talk about the fact that in Ikana, where everything has a storied history, the Stone Tower is just kind of present and not given that same history.
Good point. Any other notes before we go to the bosses?
You play the Elegy of Emptiness a lot. It gets kind of cumbersome eventually.
Would you like to play a patch that makes the Elegy of Emptiness not take so long to play?
I'm good, thank you.
Okay.
There's this center pool room that is annoying to navigate.
Oh, that's like straight ahead, like underneath the Majora Mask?
Yeah. It's like awkward to get over some of these ledges, basically. And I always forget that you can use a Deku Link to hop on the water here to help it make it easier.
Yeah, I definitely forgot that.
Oh, that room. Wait. The pool. And it's got the Igor, you mean?
Yeah, Igor's here. I almost forgot about Igor till you said his name.
Yeah, I don't remember using Deku Link to hop across that either.
There's like a thing to get one of the, I think one of the stray fairies, it's like on a platform and it's really obnoxious until you realize that you can just hop over.
Wait, is that the platform that I spent so long trying to jump up to out of the water with Zoro
Link? Yes! Now you know.
And I should have used Deku Link to...
Uh-huh.
Well, now I'm mad.
Uh-huh, I was too. Remember, very beginning of the game, it's like one of your critical skills that you get this far in and forget that you have.
You're really being tested on everything.
Yep.
This will be on the test.
Well, cuss me.
Okay. Igor.
Yeah, Igor is here too.
My guy from Link to the Past is back.
Again, and he's like a nasty version.
Yeah, he is.
Like, Link to the Past, he's basically just a statue that walks around, but this is some kind of crazy laser robot.
Yeah. Okay, that's all I got. Do you have anything else, okay. Sarah, before we talk about mid-bosses?
I think this dungeon has some cool puzzles. I like the puzzles in here.
Yeah.
There's a puzzle where you have to turn stuff upside down. You have to turn the whole room upside down and move blocks around.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a good one.
Yeah.
That whole sequence is cool.
It does take a long time, but it's still a really cool idea. And you have to, like, picture the room upside down in order to get the block where it's supposed to go. And that's cool.
And they do a good job of the room before that being kind of the same thing, but a lot easier, where you need to flip it around and then be Goron Link and then get to a platform and then flip it around again. That's like mm-hmm. almost a Mario level version of like simple idea, complicated mm-hmm. idea.
Yeah, there's like a string of those puzzles, right?
Yeah.
That's cool. You can use the flipping as part of the puzzles, like within the flipping of the temple itself.
Yeah.
And you flip the armor guys, the armos with the little symbol on them.
The death armos.
The death armos.
They have the bloody emblem on them, so you know that you can flip them over.
That's cool.
And in both those cases, flipping over is, and of course they depict it this way in when you flip the dungeon, as a rotation. But they treat those as a true rotation instead of a reflection like the main dungeon is. Which is fine.
Yeah. It's an echo of the other kind of flipping.
Yeah. There's also the big room at the back that you never get to see flipped over. You know what I mean? It has the fans that Deku Link is going to fly through and the lava that Goron Link is going to roll through.
Hmm.
And it's a pretty cool, frustrating room. I don't think we've talked much about it on this podcast how the game uses fire as an interesting obstacle that will kill Deku Link or Zoro Link immediately, but that Goron Link doesn't care about. And this room is a good example of that, where the upper section of the chamber is for Deku Link and the lower version is for Goron Link, and each is completely useless on the other side of this room. I mean, it's easy, but it's cool how that happens.
Yeah, that is cool. That's a good idea.
Should we talk, can about, we talk about bosses?
Some bosses? Let's
yeah.
Talk yeah.
Some bosses. So okay. Who's first?
Garo Master's first.
That's a cool guy.
You get to his room, and he jumps in from the ceiling, which will later become a weird portal that leads to the dimension where you fight the dungeon's boss in.
Yes, so it's a boss portal both times.
Yeah, I don't know if that means that's he can't. Does he come from that creepy desert? Who can say?
Hey,
I buy it.
You gotta that. I'm gonna write that down.
He's just kind of a guy. You fight I don't have anything memorable to say about this boss fight, this mini boss.
It's a good sword fight.
Yeah.
You know, in a game where you gotta give, like, since there's so much for other versions of Link to do with weapons that are not swords, and so much focus on shooting things with arrows, it's important to have these moments that are like actual duels with guys with swords, the way that Ocarina of Time was more interested in doing. And I think it's interesting that he's the Garou Master. He's connected to the plot outside of the dungeon. And he talks to you.
Yeah, he helps you.
That's not done anywhere else in this game. I'm trying to remember what other mini-bosses are just guys from the world.
Well, there's our guy, Master Stalfos, obviously.
Of course. Of course.
Thinking very hard. Pass. I'm sure there's examples, but I cannot think of a single one right now.
It seems like something they would do more in later games, right? But nothing is coming to mind.
I mean, you fight Ghirahim in Skyward Sword as the boss to several dungeons.
Yeah, that could...
That's not as fun as what we're talking about here, though.
No, you're right, yeah.
We love incidental guys here. We don't love, like, major plot-relevant characters, right?
I mean, that's fine to have major plot-relevant characters show up in dungeons, but it's not as interesting in this specific case.
Yeah, we're looking for, like, randos that, like, what's his name from Smurfing? Boomer, the random samurai that shows up in Super Mario RPG that you fight and is implied to be this bigger character that you've never met before. Maybe that's not what we're talking about. I just like talking
that's
about
close.
Super Boomer Mario RPG. Good.
It's a lot like in Superstar Saga, where what's his face? Popple keeps showing up?
Sure, yeah. I feel like none of these metaphors are quite, or none of these other examples are quite getting to what we're looking for, though.
Nothing is as good as Garou Master or Master Stalfos, who are both masters.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, we get the light arrows. We haven't talked about that yet.
Oh, that's a good point.
You get the light arrows. They make them more useful here by letting you solve the, like, light reflection puzzles with them, which is really cool.
Oh, yeah. The light arrows didn't do that to the suns in Ocarina of Time.
Probably. I would never know, because I've never...
You get them so late that you're not going to go back to the spirit temple.
I'm going to say... Try them out. Yeah. They probably don't actually function that way in that game. Probably.
The light arrows. They get a different role here. Because they're not like the silver arrows or whatever that are the only thing that can fell Ganon. They're a legendary power, but their position in the fiction seems very different, wouldn't you say?
They're not like a plot element at all. They're just another tool.
They're a dungeon item.
Yeah.
But they feel something about them, maybe the fact that they, their power to activate the emblems and make stuff flip upside down seems like that's not something that's just obvious about shooting light at something, right?
No.
And so it feels like there's a little more world building, but in a vague Majora's Mask way, that these light arrows are part of some other legend that we're not seeing, and that's why they can flip stuff upside down.
It's like another element that we don't know about. Like, we kind of know what to do with ice arrows and fire arrows, just from living our lives. But, but we have to learn what to do with the light arrows.
And it's a good thing that Garou Master teaches us.
Yeah.
Before he blows himself up.
I wonder if that has to do with why the boss that gives you the light arrows is a Garrow Master. If the mini boss who supplies this dungeon item has to be someone who can explain how to use it.
That makes sense.
I mean, they could have just narrated that, you know what I mean? In like description text, I guess.
Maybe.
They could have. Or like at a sign or something.
Yes. A sign in front of the entrance to Stone Tower Temple saying, yeah. Shoot this with the light arrow.
I'm really glad they didn't do that. This is a really cool moment, too, when you realize that you can do that.
It's a good game. I approve.
Yeah, it's good.
We got another mid-boss coming up. It's our guy. He's here. It's Wizro.
He's here again. Ain't been here since, like, 5 minutes ago.
Wizro just keeps showing up. I had forgotten he was in this game that much. And every time he pops up again, I start laughing about it.
I wonder if this one is the one that is too many Wizrobes.
We'll see. Who can say?
Well, there's going to be another one who I think would be fine if this one wasn't there. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's probably valid.
Especially since it was just in Ikana Castle. What are they trying to say about Wizrobe?
Wizrobe is like a put-on middle manager of a boss in this game. Who's constantly having to, like, keep getting pulled in for more and more work. He's having to do overtime, and he's not happy about it.
Zach, we try not to be autobiographical on this podcast.
Anyway.
Yeah, you fight him. He, like, is a definite mini-boss who doesn't straightforwardly unlock anything or give you a big reward.
No.
You know? And maybe that's a, like, ultimate dungeon thing of having additional mid-bosses who aren't there for normal mid-boss reasons.
Yeah. That's classic.
They could use someone else, though.
No.
I don't know who it would
be. Nobody else is available. All the other mid-bosses are busy.
You know, this dungeon could use some Lizilfos or Dinolfos. I think that would fit right in.
Maybe they don't do so well at this altitude.
Anyway, the next mid-boss is extremely radical.
Yeah.
It's Gomez.
Oh, yeah.
Who is the Grim Reaper.
It's Death from Castlevania. He's here.
And he's a ton of bats around him. And he has a scythe with a Stahlchild skull on the end of it. And, I know that similar, like, Grim Reaper-y fellows have been in, I think there were one or two in the Oracles.
Yes.
But is there any precedent before Majora's Mask for this kind of boss showing up?
No.
Okay. So it's like, for the spooky Zelda game, we're going to bring in the ultimate spookster, the Grim Reaper.
Man, this game's intense.
Yes. And it's maybe the dungeon's only nod to the idea that this is the undead part of the map.
Yeah. There's not a real thematic through line there specifically, except for this boss and the other mid-boss.
And he's cool. There's, in the 3DS version, there's this really big design on the floor. And there are four glyphs for, like, the four corners of the world. Or at least that's how I'm interpreting them. That are, like, just more Grezzo stuff. Just loving to put details all over the place. Check it out in Noclip when you get a chance.
Listener.
Yeah, listener.
I like that he's basically, like, made up of a bunch of those bad bats, which now in my head canon, they're connected, obviously. They're the only game that has the evil bat specifically, and it's this guy. He's been sending them out this whole time.
You know, the design on the floor really looks like almost a cursive version of the normal Hylian script. Like, that's this is definitely a bunch of Hylian script stuff. Shoot. I have to bring this back to the lab. There's something going on here. Those Grezzo guys.
Those Grezzo guys.
Just when I think I'm out, I get friggin' pulled back in. What other stuff is in this game? Sorry, I get distracted by Hylian text.
I think we're ready to talk about the boss of the dungeon, the actual boss.
Oh, I want to say two things about Gomez.
Okay.
One, I wanted to find out, like, if the name was coming from anything. And all I know is that the katakana that here is transliterated as Gomez is also how you write, like, the name Gomez. So imagine that this Grim Reaper guy is just a guy named Gomez, and that's fun.
That is fun.
It's also continuing the thing where the dungeon item is used to defeat the guy who has the boss key. Which, I made that case early on, and I want to prove that I'm correct. And I am. Let's go to the actual boss. Let's go back to that weird room where we fought the guy. What's his name?
Garrowmaster.
And let's go just jump into, oh, it's so creepy, into the sky, into a portal, into the desert of the real, where we'll defeat face twin mold. Yeah. You guys talk about twin mold.
So twin mold is just them doing twin mold worms. I have a chart where I was trying to figure out, you got mold worms and you got tails, and you got a whole bunch of variations of those two worm enemies basically throughout Zelda. And so here we've got twin mold. So it's like two mold worms, even though they're like, yeah, segmented worm guys. I watched this fight in N64 and in the 3D and in the 3D version, and it's different in both. Should we talk about, what order do we want to talk about stuff in? I can just
talk about Nintendo 64 first.
I will talk about the Nintendo 64. It was originally called the Nintendo Ultra 64, and on the Nintendo Ultra 64, you'd fight twin mold by either just shooting them with arrows of various types, or using the Giant's Mask, which we haven't talked about yet. In the 64 version, you actually pick up the Giant's Mask, like, in the dungeon, just organically. It's just in there. But it says you can't use it till you get to here. And in this fight, you can put on the Giant's Mask to become real big. And you can then just run up and stab these big worm guys that are not so big now. And it's very, like, primitive compared to what Grezzo came up with, basically. Mm-hmm. Because this is maybe the most changed. Is this the most changed boss fight in the 3D version?
I gotta say it is.
It's pretty remarkable. I was gonna throw it to Sarah, but Sarah's
What happens in the 3DS version?
You do like a bit of wrestling, basically. You fight one of them by shooting arrows at the worms, but they have the eyeballs this time. So you're shooting for the eyeballs instead of just like shooting for the center mass. Or wherever. And so you have to defeat one of them with arrows. And then you get the Giant's Mask. And you're allowed to put the Giant's Mask on. And then you become, like, Giant Link, which is now, like, a separate form of Link.
Wow.
Where instead of just being bigger and having your usual, like, attacks, all your attacks become, like, Link is a giant kaiju doing big, over-exaggerated swings and stuff.
Whoa, that's pretty cool.
And, like, you have to, like, grapple Twin Mold and, like, throw it into stuff. And then, like, the eyeball will pop out. Then you can fight the eyeball. It's very exaggerated. Is that all right, Ryan?
Yeah.
That sounds about right, yeah. I forget the exact definition of how you, or how do you get, like, the chest with the mask in it just shows up after you kill one of the guys?
I think that's the order of events. It does just show up in that desert void area.
Okay.
They, like, that's very really much say, idea. No, here you go. You have to use this to do this in this version of the game. Because in 64, yeah, because you can in the just original opt out version, of this.
Yeah, they just, they're like, here's your mask that you're going to need. And yeah, that's cool. I like that.
Well, I don't. they, what Zach didn't tell you is that they make this fight take forever and it's not fun. It's not even that fun to be giant, like, pro wrestler Link because the controls are awkward and it's not what you're used to. And, you get to Bowser throw, you know, Mario 64, like, swing around and throw the worm, which is kind of cool. But they made some serious mistakes with, like, just how Twin Mold takes damage.
Yeah.
Such that if you don't know exactly what the mechanics are, you can spend a really long time trying to beat this boss. It's like, you have to wear it down to where it becomes vulnerable. So you have to, like, deal first stage damage before you can deal true damage to the eyeball. But that first stage damage resets whenever Twin Mold burrows underground. And so if you don't hit it, like, the optimal number of times while it's in the air, then you don't accomplish anything. It's real bad.
And it'll, like, get a hit in on you, and then that throws off your rhythm, and it's it just has too much.
Yeah, none of this sounds great.
It is cool to look at, and I assume that Grezzo had some sort of problem with how the original worked. Maybe it was too easy, that they wanted to fix with this, and so, like, if I knew what their goal was, then we could evaluate it on those terms, but I don't like it.
I mean, I guess a lot of those boss, you know, now that we've gotten through all four dungeons, like, a lot of the boss fights were just kind of uninteresting before, or, like, not mechanically rich enough. Like, maybe they had, like, a hook to them, but, like, they didn't do anything with that hook necessarily.
I see where you're coming from. Yeah,
maybe they just wanted to spice things up, but they needed to go a little lighter on this one, maybe.
Yep.
Hmm. It's weird. Like the idea of getting the mask in the middle of the fight, though.
Yeah, it's a cool fight. Like, on paper, it's cool. It just is a little undercooked.
Yeah.
Or overcooked, I guess.
One or the other.
I've lost my cooking metaphor. It's gone.
They needed to spice it up, but they overcooked it. Is that what you're saying?
No, they, like, maybe left it on the burner for a little too long and also put, like, too much salt, not enough pepper.
Okay. Now I get it. Well, after we defeat Twin Mold, we get to go to the Heaven Realm, where we meet the last giant. And Zach, did you research this conversation with the giant?
I did. The giant first says, call us. And Tattle is like, they sound sad. Like, they don't want to confront. She doesn't say that. But that's my notes. She says they sound sad and she asks why. And there's an implied question of, like, why. And the giants respond, just, forgive your friend. And we know at this point, because we played all the game, exactly what they're talking about. And I feel like Tattle also kind of knows.
Yeah, this is where Tattle has stopped being, like, clueless.
Yeah.
And has solved the mystery in the player's place.
Because Link's not going to solve it. He's a empty body.
Ah, there's that metaphor again.
Yeah. He's just that we're a creepy face now. He's
the empty shell of us.
Oh, he's just a link between us and the computer world.
You could say like that,
Tron.
But yeah.
Yeah.
We beat the game.
We beat the game. We got all four dragons. And there's not much left to do except... Well, okay, there's two things we have to do. First, we have to go around Ikana, talk about Dompei, talk about the cool optional stuff to do in Ikana. But before we can do that, we have to tell each other our top 10 dungeons.